was one of them. There's something about that name, isn't it? Well, I call your attention to 1 Samuel 30. We began this chapter last week. We'll finish it next week. And so tonight, we have the middle message of the three out of 1 Samuel 30. The title of the message tonight is found in verse, I believe it's number 11. And they found an Egyptian in the field. And they found an Egyptian in the field. When our kids were teenagers, Sarah, I guess, was a little over 16 years old, and that meant that Dallas was 14 and Allison was not a teenager yet. She was 11. But after a few months, we decided that we would allow Sarah to drive the other two to school. And so we had an old car that we bought. I think that Deb's mom and dad helped pay for part of it. And it was an 89 or a 90 Camry. Had four doors. It was blue. It was old. And it was cheap. And so we got that car. Can I tell you that as my wife and I would drive around, whether it was coming to work or her going on a trip somewhere to the grocery store or somewhere, can I tell you that we started seeing blue Camrys everywhere? Have you ever had an experience like that? Where when you bought a vehicle or you got your kids a vehicle, the next thing you know, you see them everywhere. I had a 2006 Nissan Titan. Love that red truck. I started seeing those things everywhere. Now, it wasn't so bad I dreamed about them at night, but I saw them everywhere. And before I got that truck, never thought about it. Before Sarah got that little blue car, never thought about it. Can I tell you that the unseen hand of God is kind of like that? If you start looking for it, you see it. We don't always connect the dots the way that we ought to. And I believe that this passage tonight is going to bear that thought out. When you think about the situation that David was in, last week we found him to the point where these men were about to stone him because their wives and kids had been kidnapped. And so what does he do? He encouraged himself in the Lord. These men are murmuring. They're thinking about the fact that, yeah, he's led us on a lot of battles and he's made right decisions. But this may be a bridge too far here, the fact that he's got our families kidnapped. And so they spake of stoning him in verse number 6. But he went to the Lord. And we know that because he called for Abiathar and he said, bring me the linen ephod. Can I tell you, this is the first time David has asked for the ephod from the priest since chapter 23. He goes and invokes God. But this is the first time that he's invoked God since chapter 26. And so it's been a little while, and David has not always made really good decisions because he has not been seeking the Lord. I don't think that it was God's will for him to leave Israel and go into Philistine country. And the Philistine king of the city-state of Achish, he gave him a little town called Ziklag, and it was a barren place out in the countryside. But David took that place, and even though it was in the land of Judah, It was still under Philistine control, but he moved his merry band of men and their families there, and he began to basically just kind of carve out a life there. I believe that he should have stayed in Israel and let God continue to protect him as he had always done. But then I began to think, well, who am I to criticize David, the greatest king that Israel ever had? I mean, I've got 20-20 hindsight. And so I look at what's happening in the first part of the chapter, and I can't help but connect two things. In our text tonight, after David inquired of the Lord in verse number 8, which I touched on last week, he said, "Shall I overtake them?" And God answered him, "Pursue, and thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail you're going to recover all." And so if you look at verse number 9, it says, David went, he and the 600 men that were with him. You know, there's not a lot of space between verse 6 and a lot of time passed between verse 6 and verse 9. In verse 6, probably only a couple of hours ahead of time, they're saying, let's stone him. And now here they are, let's follow him. And sometimes we Christians can get a little fickle. You know, we can click along pretty good, and all of a sudden, just a circumstance crop up in our life, and we have something happen, and the next thing you know, we have done a 180, and we're going in a totally different direction. And that's what we see with David's men. I also can't help but compare the contrast of two men. David is one of them, but then you think about Saul. Both of these men are looking for help. They're seeking advice. Where does Saul go for his advice? He goes to the witch at Endor. Where does David go? He goes to Abathar and to the ephod. And then he comes before God after he has gotten the ephod. So Saul's with a witch, David's with the Lord. Well, what else do we see? We see that there's going to be two battles that take place. Now there's going to be many, many miles apart. There are about 60 miles difference between where Saul is at and where David is at. You remember Ziklag was a 3-day journey. And so you've got 60 miles that have separated these men, and now David is going to have to go another day's journey because the wadi, the little creek called Bezor, that is about 15 miles south of Ziklag. And so you've got two battles that are going to take place. You have two men that sought different sources, and you're going to have two outcomes that are different. Saul is actually going to die. We'll see that in the coming weeks. He's going to die. But then David, he's going to be elevated in victory. And so when we put all of these things together and we look at verse number 11, which is kind of our focal point tonight, how many times have you looked back and with hindsight, you've been able to see the unseen hand of God directing you in your life? Oh, I can do it. I can think about some of the things that God has brought my way, and there's no doubt about it that it was God that brought it that way. There have been times when God has not only brought things my way, God has kept me from going a certain way. I mean, we have all of these plans that we make, and then all of a sudden, bam, God changes those plans. I think about something that changed my life. In 1976, my wife graduated from high school. In the fall of that year, she had already been accepted to go to Tennessee Temple up in Chattanooga. But at the last minute, she decided she didn't want to go to Tennessee Temple. She wanted to come to Atlanta and go to BUA. And because of that one decision, our lives were totally changed. She and I met. Had she been in Chattanooga and I been in Atlanta, we'd have never met. But yet that one little decision changed our whole life. And I can tell you that I really believe this, and I believed it in 1978 when we got married. I believe it until tonight, and I've believed it every day during that time, that it was the hand of God that brought us to the same place, to that same little school over in Decatur, Georgia. And so you can think of situations that have happened in your life and how that circumstances and things that just kind of came in or left or you were kept from doing, that you could see the hand of God. Now tonight, if you look at verse number 11, you'll see that this Egyptian was left in the field. Now we're going to get into why he was left there here in a moment, but let me just say this. He belonged to an Amalekite. This Amalekite master, I don't know if he was the king of the Amalekites or if he was just some guy that owned people, but this man that was the leader or one of the leaders in the Amalekite tribes, he had an Egyptian that was his slave. And he thought so little of him that when this man got sick, he just cast him aside and left him to die in the desert. And so you've got that one little decision that a man thinks is insignificant. But I believe that this whole passage tonight hinges upon that one little decision. Now let's look at verse number 9, and we'll begin to wade through some of the text. And David went, he and the 600 men that were with him, and they came to the brook Bezor, where those that were left behind stayed. Now, who had been left behind? There were 600 men to begin with, but 200 of them were so tired that they literally could not go any farther. They said, we can't go anymore. So 400, his army is reduced by a third. Now God has already promised him that he's going to have victory. But David had 600 when God promised that. And then all of a sudden, your army is depleted by a third. Would you not begin to wonder, is that promise still valid? Well, when God makes a promise, it doesn't matter if it's hundreds or if it's one. It's the promise of God. I don't know what great preacher started it, but there's been many preachers that have said this. You and a majority with God are going to win. And so David took 400 men and he began to pursue. Now, in verse number 11, when they find the Egyptian in the field, they brought him to David. They gave him bread. He did eat, and they made him drink water. They gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit came again to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk any water 3 days and three nights. In other words, he was just about dead. You can't go more than about 4 days without water. Now you can go for a couple of weeks without food, but you can't go more than about 4 days without water. And so here he is, he's just laying there almost dead. And David said unto him, to whom belongest thou? Whence art thou? And he said, I am a young man of Egypt, serving in Amalekite, and my master left me because 3 days agone, or 3 days ago, I fell sick. We made an invasion upon the south of the Cherethites, and upon the coast which belongeth to Judah, and upon the south of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. Now, I read it all the way down through that so that I could ask you another question. You say, boy, you're asking us a lot of questions tonight. It's because I want you to think. Had David and his men not come upon the Egyptian, how would they have found the Amalekites? The Amalekites are a nomadic tribe. They float from this place to that place to this place to that place. They are a nomadic people. We would probably call them Bedouins. And so you've got these people, and they go from here to there. Nobody knows what direction they're going in. There's no plan. They don't have a plan where they're going to say, well, we'll stay here 3 months, we'll go here 3 months. They're just all over the place, wherever they happen to think that there's some place that they can raid. I mean, this was basically a traveling band of marauders, and there were multiple tribes. Now, if there was trouble, because you remember only a couple of three chapters ago, David has been killing some Amalekites. And no doubt the word has spread that David has killed them. And so they come to the place where David's people are at, and it's a miraculous thing that they don't kill anybody. Is that not, again, the hand of God protecting? When we look in our own lives, and maybe you're looking to see this red light take off, or when it turns green, you take off, and then something distracts you, and you look this way, the light turns green, and before you can accelerate, somebody zooms through the intersection, and the first thought is, wow, if I would have taken off immediately, I could have been T-boned. I think in those terms nowadays. Years ago, I did not think in those terms, but I'm telling you, I've got to the point to where I'm looking for the hand of God in the things that happen in my life. Now you say, oh, that's just crazy, preacher. I really believe that little things make a big difference in the long run. In carpentry, I've given this illustration a couple of times in the last 30 or 40 years. In carpentry, if you have a 4 foot level and you're putting that level on a piece of wood, and you're trying to make sure that it's completely level across, but you get that bubble off in a 4 foot span, if you get it off a quarter of an inch, in other words, it's not inside of the lines. Can I tell you that when you get to the 8 foot mark, that is not a quarter inch off, it's now a half inch off? When you get to the 12 foot mark, it's not a half inch, it's 3/4 of an inch. And every 4 feet that you go, it's another quarter inch. And so by the time you get out there 30 or 40 feet, you started back here wrong, and you're way wrong out here. Now, it's just a little quarter inch. You say, oh, that little decision doesn't matter. But can I say little decisions mount up to be big decisions? I was talking to a man that he spent time in jail. And I was talking with him, and I told him, I said, and I called his name, I said, every day, you've got to make good little decisions. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, when you get some money, you can't go and gamble it away. If you expect to pay your bills, you got to take care of it at the beginning because there won't be any at the end. I said, you need to be careful who you hang out with. If you're hanging out with folks that do wrong, ultimately, you're going to do wrong. Water always seeks its own level. And so I talked to him about just little things like go to bed, get up. Go to work, work hard, come home, don't drink, get good rest, eat good food. Basically, common sense type things. And yet you've got folks that cannot do that regularly. They choose not to do it regularly, and they look up a year later and go, man, how did I get where I'm at? It's because you didn't do little things over a long period of time. You didn't do them right. And so you've got David. How's he going to find his family? Those two wives that have been taken, those other men's wives and their kids, they've been taken. How are you going to find them? I mean, there's footprints going in all directions. But there was an Egyptian, somebody that was insignificant. This Amalekite master could not have cared any less for human life than to just cast this man aside. And so when you begin to look at this Egyptian, I really can't help but believe that this man is a picture of you and I when we were lost. If you look at this Egyptian, the first thing you look at is you look at the situation that the man was in. In verse number 11, in verse number 13, it tells us some things about him. It says that he was an Egyptian, which means he was a type of the world. He was in the field, which is another type of the world. If you look at what he says, I think it's in verse number 13. Yes, it is. He said, I am a young man of Egypt. In other words, I'm a young man of the world. He had already lived long enough to get involved in evil. You say, now, preacher, how do you say that? Well, was he not involved at the burning of Ziklag? That's a pretty wicked thing to do. Was he not involved in the kidnapping? You say, well, he was a slave. He didn't have any choice about it. Well, let me ask you something. At Nuremberg, did the Nazis that followed orders, did they have any choice? According to the Nuremberg trials, they did. There are some orders that you don't follow, even if it means your own life. And so this man had already been involved with evil as a young man. Not only that, but he was a slave. Were we not slaves to sin before we met Christ? I mean, we were in bondage. And sin was our slave master. We were on the auction block. I mean, we were being sold to the highest bidder. You say, oh, no, it wasn't that bad. Let me tell you something. We were all lost and undone. We were all short of the glory of God. There was none of us that were righteous. No, not a one of us. And so we see that not only was he a slave and he was young and he was in a field and he was an Egyptian, but there's also the fact that he was sick. We were sick. We had the disease of sin that coursed through our veins. I hear people say things like this, well, I really wasn't that bad. That's just because you don't know how bad you really are. A few days ago, there was a man that was in a hospital. I went to visit him. He was in intensive care. And they finally got him out of intensive care. They were talking to him, and they said, we found some spots on your kidneys, and we need to do a biopsy. And he said, what's that? Or he said, what's that? They said, well, that's where we get a picture and a mark, and we go in with a needle and take a little piece of it so that we can see what it is. He said, no. You're not sticking that needle into me. I don't want to know that stuff. He was sick, but he didn't really want anybody to tell him how sick he was. That's not even smart. I mean, if you're sick, you want to know if there's some help that you can get. You know, if you're not feeling good, you know, get you some elderberry juice, you know. I can't tell you how many people have asked me about that today. All right? And so this man is a type of the sinner. But not only that, it's also his situation, a type of our salvation. If you think about it, he was found out in the field. Where were you at when you were found? And let me just tell you this. You didn't find Jesus. He was looking for you a long time before you ever got to him. He was looking for you. He was searching for you. And he finally found you. And your life has never been the same. Because there's something about that name. And so, not only was he found in the field, but he was also brought to David. Is that not a wonderful picture of maybe the person that brought you to Christ? I think about the people that were instrumental in bringing me to Christ. As a child growing up, my parents were very, very active in church. My dad was a trustee. My mom was a Sunday school teacher. My dad would wear his uniform some on Sundays, and he would help let the traffic out over on Skidaway Road. I mean, they were very, very active. And I mean, when we went to church, we went Wednesdays, mission conferences, revivals. I mean, we went to the everything, all right? And so he was brought to David. I think about not only my parents, I think about guys like Mr. Goodley. He was the fifth and sixth grade boy Sunday school teacher. He was just a common layperson, but yet he taught that fifth and sixth grade boys class for years. Planted seeds. And the seeds that had been planted began to get watered by guys like Bob Cavanis. And he would say, "Hey, Tommy, why don't you come and go with us? We're going to go up to the Y and play basketball." And of course, if they asked me to play basketball back then, that was like, "Yeah, let's go." And it had to be one of the sorriest gyms in the whole city of Savannah. They had the backboards mounted against the wall. There was no such thing as going in straight for a layup. Not unless you wanted to crash into the wall. So you had to kind of do a layup from the side. But old Bob Cavanis, every time they would take a group to the Y, "Hey, Tommy, come on, go to the Y with us." And then they'd preach to us. And I'd hear some more preaching. And I'd get some more watering. And I'd get some more fertilizing. And finally, by the time I was almost 16, that's when I finally trusted the Lord. But I was being brought to Jesus a long time before I knew it. And no doubt we've got some young people that are coming through our church right now, and they don't even realize it, but we're planting those seeds, and we're watering those seeds, and we're fertilizing those seeds. And one of these days, that kid's going to get saved, and they're going to be doing something great for God. And so they brought him to Jesus. Well, if you look at verse 14, he's got the mark of a true believer. He confessed his sin. What did he say in verse 14? "We burned Ziklag." He didn't say they burned it. He said we did it. We burned it. He acknowledged his own sin. Can I tell you that that's one of the reasons that I think people get saved is because they say, "It was my fault. It was my fault." Some of you remember one of the men in the church from a long time ago named Danny Hubbard. Danny lives over in Alabama now, and from time to time we get an email about something that Danny will send out. But he used to work in a computer room at a big lumber and concrete company down near Atlanta. And something happened at that computer room one day. And there was a big, big meeting with the executives. And they were looking to hang somebody out to dry. And so, I don't know if it was the CEO or one of the VPs said something like this: "Well, I'd like for you guys in the computer department to just tell me what happened." Well, of course, you could say, "Well, the computer crashed. Well, you know, I mean, the software needs to be updated." And they could have gone through all the normal things where people, you know, blame the hardware or the software. But Danny spoke up and he said, "It was my fault." He said, "I didn't do it the way that it was supposed to have been done." And the guy goes, "Wow, finally somebody that's honest." And I think they ended up maybe promoting him, and at one time before he left to go to Alabama, he was in charge of that department. Just because he was willing to take the blame for something that people under him had done. It just floored the CEO in that meeting. I never forgot that story, because we live in a society that we call passing the buck. And it all started with Adam when he said, "The woman which thou gave me." But when a person gets saved, they're willing to accept responsibility and to say, "I'm a sinner." You don't get saved without acknowledging your sin. Why should you? If you don't need a Savior because you haven't sinned, why ask for one? And so he confessed. Well, what was the result? David spared his life. Now, you know what the Amalekite master would have done? Well, the desert didn't kill him. I'll just kill him. And he would have probably taken some kind of weapon out, and he would have probably stabbed him or cut his head off, said, "Now you're dead." Oh, but you don't see the grace of God in the way David dealt with him, or the way that the Amalekite master, you see the grace of God in the way David did. David fed him. He gave him water. And he didn't just give him bread. He gave him Little Debbie cakes. He gave him a raisin cluster. He gave him figs. He gave him things that was going to stimulate him. And all of a sudden, this guy's like, whoo, he's reviving. That's what the Lord did for us. When we get saved, it's as though, I know the day I got saved, it was though I was not even touching the ground as I was walking, because I felt so clean, knowing that I had been born again. And so we see the Egyptian salvation, but then also you see the Egyptian service. If you look, David asked him a question in verse 15. "Canst thou bring me down to this company?" One of the things that new Christians ought to do is they ought to be asked to do things that are within their ability. Now, somebody that gets saved this week, they don't get to teach Sunday school next week. Okay? Just because somebody joins the church this week doesn't mean they get to be a deacon next week. Because there's a process, there's a way that you go about things to make sure that people are growing. Those newborn babies are to desire the sincere milk of the word, that they may grow thereby. And they go from milk and they graduate to meat, but you don't do that fast. There comes a time in the life of a newborn baby that they begin to grow teeth. And when they get those teeth, they begin to graduate from milk and I think it's called pabulum, and they begin to graduate to green peas. Now, it may have to be smushed up a little bit, but it's a little more hard in the texture than the pabulum. Oh, but when they get a full set of teeth, then all of a sudden they can begin to eat pieces of chicken. And they can begin to eat little pieces of food. Now, you may have to help it out by chewing it up a little bit or mushing it up with a spoon or a fork. But it won't be too long before that kid's eating on his or her own. Why? Because they've grown from milk into meat, but it's a process. When somebody comes into church and they join the church, that doesn't mean that they immediately get to assume a leadership position. You can't tell how much gas is in the tank by the toot of the horn. And sometimes you've got to observe, and you've got to watch, and you've got to decide over a long haul and not quick. I can't tell you the number of times that I've made that mistake, where you meet somebody and you just think, "Oh man, this is the next deacon." And 3 weeks later, you can't find them. And you go, "Where are you at?" "Well, we just ain't been coming." And I mean, when you met them the first two or three times, I mean, boy, they're talking the talk. But there's a big difference between talking the talk and walking the walk. And so this Egyptian, He was called on for service, but he was asked to do something that he could do. What can a newborn baby in Christ do? They can help give out bulletins. You know, they can help clean up a Sunday school room. They can help run some kind of kids' activity. Now, they don't get to teach, but they can run games. There's all kinds of things for people to do in a church. And so he was called on for service. Can I tell you that because of what David did for him, he was obligated to David? Can I tell you I feel obligated to Jesus? I believe that I ought to serve Jesus the rest of my life because of what he did for me in 1972. Can I tell you that I think you are obligated to Jesus? And whenever he saved you, you were placed in a job. You put your hands to the plow if you really got saved. And you ought to be walking behind that plow, and you ought to be faithful in doing what the Lord directs you to do. And so he was obligated to David. What did David want him to do? Take me down to that company. Not only that, he was prepared for service. How did he get prepared? David fed him. Can I tell you that we ought not just evangelize people? We ought to evangelize and disciple people. If you begin to look at the Great Commission over in the book of Matthew, go ye therefore and teach all nations, in other words, you give them the gospel. The next thing we're to do is to baptize them, and then we're to teach them to teach others. In other words, we're to teach them after they've been saved and they've been baptized, we teach them how they go and tell somebody else about it. One of the beautiful things that I enjoy about reading the prayer letters, and there's sometimes when I just don't enjoy reading those prayer letters from those missionaries, you know. But when they begin to talk about the people being saved and how that this person began in the church and now here it is, they've been here 5 years and now they're doing this and they've brought so many people in the church themselves, all I'm thinking is, that's good. That's good. And so he was prepared for the work that he could do. Now, why did all of this happen? He was a sinner, he was saved, and then he was pressed into service to do what he was supposed to do. How did all of this take place? Well, it took place because there was a slave master that just threw a man away. Can I tell you that everybody has got a job that they can do? We ought not throw anybody on the trash heap. We ought to have hope for everybody. Everybody doesn't have the same talents. Everybody does not have the same gifts and abilities. But just because someone is not quite as talented as somebody else, just because somebody is not quite as gifted as somebody else, that doesn't mean that they can't do something in the work of God. Years ago, I was, and I don't know why I'm thinking about my high school years now, but when I was in the youth department, there was a crippled boy, and I say a crippled boy because he was probably in his early 20s. He was older than I was. And he walked with crutches. And he would just basically, I mean, he struggled. And he wanted a bus route at our church. And the bus captain would be like, I don't really think that you can handle it. I can handle it. I'm just crippled. I can do it. I can go with my crutches. I can go door to door. And he just wouldn't take no for an answer. And so they finally gave him a bus route and got him a driver. Well, he began to knock on those doors. Well, finally, somebody said, why don't we buy him a bicycle? Not a two-wheeler now, but a bicycle that was really more of a big trike. It was a place in the back I guess we would call it a trunk, that he could lay his crutches, and he could pedal, and then there was a bell on the handlebars, and he would ring that bell, and the route that he had, it had a sidewalk, and the front doors to the homes were not really any farther from where I'm at to the front pew. And he would ring that bell, ring that bell, ring that bell, and finally somebody would come to the door, and he would say, "I'm going to be by here in a bus tomorrow. Can your kids ride my bus? We'll give them some candy." And do you know that 20-something-year-old crippled boy, do you know he had one of the largest bus routes at Bible Baptist? And all I'm thinking is, man, I'm healthy as I can be. I mean, I can do this and I can do that. And I mean, you know, it's like, you know, the old song, like a rock. I mean, I'm good. And all I'm thinking is, I'm nothing compared to this guy. God took somebody that was willing to do anything and use them in a special way. It couldn't have been him. It had to be the power of God upon him. And so, this nobody, as far as the thinking of the Egyptian master, because he got sick, he tossed him to the side. By the time David caught up to the Amalekites, he already had the lowdown on them. And if you begin to look, it says in verse 16 that when he had brought him down, brought David down, and behold, they were spread upon all the earth, eating and drinking. Now remember, David's only got 400. 200 of them stayed back at Bezor. But you've got 400 guys, and I'm telling you, these guys evidently are on adrenaline. All right? I mean, they've been marching for 3 days to get back to Ziklag. They get there, and they begin to wail because their families are not there, and they're crying, and I mean, emotionally they're just spent, and they're saying, "We're going to kill David." And then David goes, "No, we're going after him. God's told me that we're going to get him back." And they fall in line, and now they march for another day. And when they get there, the Amalekites are spread out all over the place, and they've been eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. In other words, they had been on a little march, and they had gone from this place to that place to this place, and the last place they went was Ziklag, and they took everything they could get, including the people. Probably going to sell the women or use the women. Sell the kids and get money out of it, just like Joseph's brothers did him. But yet, here they are. They're thinking, Philistine's not going to bother us. They're 60 miles away about to fight Saul. But they don't remember David. And in verse 17, he said, or the scriptures tell us that David smote them from the twilight even unto evening of the next day. In other words, they killed them all through the night. They killed them during the day the next day. And so roughly a 24-hour period, they're killing Amalekites. I mean, they are wiping them out. And the only ones that got away were 400 that jumped on camels and took off. Now I'm going to tell you, those boys must have been agile, because it's not easy getting on a camel. But they got on these 400 camels, and I mean, off they went. As the old Ray Stevens song, I mean, they were riding like Ahab the Arab. All right? And so, in verse 18, the Bible says that David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives. There was nothing lacking to them, neither small nor great, neither sons nor daughters, neither spoil, nor anything that had taken to them. David recovered all. And David took all the flocks and the herds which they drave before those other cattle and said, this is David's spoil. So not only did David get everything that had been taken back, he got more. And that, isn't that the way God is? He just gives us more. We ask for a certain amount and he just gives us more. When I think of God just giving us more, I think of a story about Spurgeon. Charles Spurgeon was, and probably still is, considered to be the prince of preachers, in, at least in English countries. I couldn't understand Spurgeon when I first got saved, and it's because I was a milk drinker. But I've got to where I really kind of like Spurgeon now, you know, 40 plus years later. But Spurgeon got saved, and he joined a Baptist church. And his mother had been a Christian, but she was a Congregationalist. And she wrote him one day, and she said, dear Charles, I am so happy, and I have prayed when you were a small boy that you would become a Christian. But I never prayed or believed that you would become a Baptist. And he wrote her back and he said, oh, mother, isn't that just like the Lord to give us abundantly more than we ever ask or think? And so God always gives us more. Now, for years, I wrestled with this thought. Why did God constantly tell his people to annihilate the Amalekites? You remember over, and I think it's in 1 Samuel 15, I think it is, when Saul was told to annihilate them, men, women, children, animals, and he brought back, and Samuel the great prophet said, did you do what you were told? Oh, yeah. And then Samuel said, then what means the lowing of the cattle and the bleeding of the sheep? Well, I kept back a little bit, you know, just so that we could offer sacrifice. But that's not what God told him to do. And often I've thought, because of my Western thinking, boy, isn't that horrible? That God said, kill the men, the women, and the kids. Do you know why God had such a hatred for that group of people? It all went back hundreds of years. Because when God had Moses leading the people out of bondage, what you've got is you've got some people that were feeble and people that were fainting. And they, in that million plus group of people, they were in the back. And when they got to a place called Rephidim, I think that's the way you pronounce that word, Rephidim, the Amalekites came out from behind and they began to kill the feeble and the old and those that were so tired that they could not fight back. All the strong men were up front. And so, an act of cowardice, they came in the back and they began to kill the weakest. And because of that one act, God started telling people like Moses and Saul, kill them all. And they didn't do it. And because of that, they'd have to fight them again. But it was because of the act that they did against God's people when they left Egypt. That's why God kept saying, you kill them all. That's why. When I learned that, I was like, I'm good with it. You know what? God's ways are not my ways. His ways are higher than my ways. His wisdom is greater than my wisdom. I'm okay with it. I don't have to have an explanation, as I mentioned this morning, a quote from Wiersbe. All I've got is the promises of God, and that's all I need. And so, do you see the unseen hand of God now? Tomorrow, when you're on your way to work, or you're on your way to get you a biscuit, you're on your way to a grocery store, you're on your way to school, wherever you're at, and all of a sudden something happens. Will you see the unseen hand of God then? I hope that you'll start looking. I hope that you'll see the unseen hand of God here, just like I saw Blue Camrys. And I hope you'll see the unseen hand of God here, just like I see Red Titans. Think about God in your life and let that be a part of your everyday thought process. And I believe that if you'll do that, you'll realize that there really are no little decisions, even though the world would say, that doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. For the child of God, it matters. Let's stand. Wow. Father, I want to thank you for a good day.